I often say that addiction is the result of not knowing how to find safety inside of yourself. So you find it in something else, and understandably, you get hooked on it because you're desperate for safety. That's all you're guilty of. Any of you looking to learn more about supporting addiction recovery through a trauma-informed and somatic lens and a nutritional lens, please join me for my addiction circle. This is a bi-monthly, entirely free virtual circle that I invite anyone here to come and join if they want more information. Addiction tends to be so steeped in shame, and I find that doing this work in a community of people helps to destigmatize that shame so you can see how not alone you are in the experience. So whether you are personally withdrawing, preventing, experiencing relapse, or you work with people who are actively addicted or in recovery, all are welcome.
The next Addiction Circle will be held on Tuesday, May 7th at 5 p.m. EDT. This meeting is not recorded for the sake of anonymity. No registration is necessary. Just join through the link below.
On today's episode, I welcome my friend Kaylin Manning to speak with me about our experiences growing up with gender dysphoria, the gifts, the pain, and really the wisdom that we gained from the experience.
I remember telling, when I was 7, I told everybody, I am a boy. And, you know, my parents didn't care. They were like, oh, last week he thought he was a buffalo, right? So they indulged me. I got all my cousin's old clothing. I wore boots. And then when I was 10, I was told I couldn't be because I was missing a penis. And that just sort of, my mind just sort of exploded, for lack of a better phrase, because I thought that it would happen. I thought when I hit 13 or 12, I would get that.
Welcome to the Holistic Life Navigation Podcast, where we discuss every aspect of life through the lens of somatic psychology, nutrition, and self-inquiry. My name is Luis Mojica, and I'm a somatic educator who teaches people how to find safety inside themselves so they can better navigate this strange and sensational human experience. Your time to learn begins now. I want to welcome my dear friend Kaylin Manning to the episode. Welcome, Kaylin.
Hello.
Let's start by just kind of celebrating our friendship history, because I think it's been 10 or 11 years now.
It's going to be 10 years in the summer of 2023.
No, I met you in 2012.
Yes, we met in 2012. We started playing music together in 2013.
Got it. That's like when you're dating, you're like, we were talking, but we started sleeping together. Dot, 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 dot. Is that how you equate? I love that. This just, Kaylin and I have a very unique relationship because his autism doesn't always understand my humor. I forget, it's been a while, so I forgot about that. So I'm enjoying this. That was a joke.
Oh, okay. I remember 2013 because I was playing with our old manager at Dave's Wine and Coffee Bar.
Oh my goddess.
Yeah.
In Saugerties. I forgot all of you. You weren't even know you were going to play. They told you to bring this. I don't even remember what happened.
I don't know if I'm allowed to say his name because he was our manager, but we'll call him Frank.
He showed
me the song for like 20 minutes at his house. He said, bring your saxophone. I said, one of the keys is broken. He said, that. And he then proceeded to put me on stage with no microphone.
I was going to say, you weren't mic'd.
No microphone at all.
No one could hear you.
Nothing. And then they just played some weird jazz 70s fusion thing. And I played like 8 notes just over and over. I played the bass line and tried to avoid the note that was broken on my saxophone.
As you talk about this, like, I get these dusty memories of the Wild West. Like, that's how I remember Woodstock and Socrates back in the day. Because there was, like, no one anywhere. It was just us in that place. It was cold out. Oh, no, was that summer or was it winter, that one?
No, it was cold.
I remember the freezing
because
cold.
Because my hands had to get used to my saxophone.
Yeah, I remember Eamon and I going in there. There was no one anywhere. It was just, like, four of us watching you.
I think, like, two people were drinking coffee.
And one was your girlfriend.
Probably. That would not surprise me.
Oh, this is the best part is for some reason that performance made me want to hire you as my saxophonist.
Yeah, you didn't even hear me.
I didn't even hear it.
You were like, saxophone.
It was a felt sense. Like, I saw you and I thought, I think he's actually really good. I just want to be able to hear it.
Yeah. And I never played with Frank again, just to throw it out there.
Oh, my gosh. Well, so what's amazing about Kalen, so him and I met when he was Gus, right?
Yeah, that was my my sort of middle.
Mm-hmm.
That was the where people would think, oh, he's just joking around. She's just joking around.
Yeah.
It was my middle, like, social transition name.
I loved it. Well, so this is what's funny. Okay, so Gus is trans. We're going to talk about this. I just said Gus is trans. Kalen is trans. We're going to talk about this a lot. Obviously, that's the whole point of what we're talking. Not the whole point, but there's so much nuance to this. But so the first time I ever laid eyes on Kalen, it was when my wife and I moved. We weren't married then. We just moved upstate from New York City. And you were at the register of Sunflower, the health food store that I ended up working at, but I wasn't working there yet. We went in there to get something. Do you remember what you said to us?
Yes, because Hurricane Irene was coming through.
Yes, it was.
You had just moved to the Hudson Valley at the worst time because Socrates, Woodstock, Phoenicia, those areas, we lose electricity so quickly. And I remember you came in and Eamon bought a little bag of peanut butter pretzels and that was it. And it was like, you guys are from the city, aren't you?
That's exactly what you said. Yeah. I was probably like twirling my hair. I'm like, yeah.
I remember you had your scarf.
My turban.
You had your turban. And I just remember thinking, like, they're in for such a rude awakening. We're going to lose power as soon as this hits. And we did. But I hope your pretzels were good.
You were so hardcore because you were, like, so, like, frustrated with city people and equally concerned and equally, like, the unofficial, the town clerk. You know, you were like, this is what it's like here. And you said, you shrugged your shoulder up to me, this annoyed face. You put both your hands on. You were like, because you'll be stuck on the mountain.
I did tell you, you'll be stuck on the mountain.
And then I just laughed and you just looked very serious at me. No, you didn't laugh with me, nothing like that. And we left and Eamon goes, that person has a little boy stuck inside of them. Yeah. And I remember telling you this like months later. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was going through such a personal, like, dysphoric night of the soul, which we'll get into more. But seeing you and feeling your spirit, I knew right away you were a kindred person.
Yeah, it's interesting how you feel that. Sometimes you just do. Mm-hmm. Like, I knew, I want to mention that what I had said to you came from a place of concern, like you said.
I was aware.
I had so many folks from Manhattan who decided to come up to the Hudson Valley for safety, who had purchased just cartfuls of frozen food. And at that point, I was just done. But I knew you two were people that I would get involved with in some way.
Yeah.
I didn't know how, but I knew.
Well, it was cool because then I got the job. And I remember the first thing, in November, they hired me. And I was only hired by Frank because I submitted my application on cardstock because I didn't have any other paper. So I printed out this resume on cardstock and it was really thick and like marbly and like, you know, what you'd print a certificate on. I remember he said I had 30 applications and that one stood out because it was on such great stationery. I was like, yes, I got in.
Yeah.
But you were one of the first people I was looking for. Cause I'm like, where's that guy? Cause I had no idea. I just thought you were a guy. I didn't know you were trans, you know? And then you were in the produce section, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we kind of orbited, and then there was that day in the back room.
Yeah.
What did I say to you?
You said, I had my breasts removed too, and then you just left like a cowboy into the sunset. and I hadn't undergone top surgery yet, and Sunflower... I remember this because this was 2012 before there was a lot of recognition.
Mm-hmm.
They were so good about letting me go by Gus and using the right pronouns. You knew automatically. You just sort of figured it out. Again, kindred spirits type of thing. You just knew automatically and you used the right pronouns. And Sunflower was really good about it. But I remember you saying that to me and then just drifting off, just floating away, and me going, And for those of you who can't see it, I'm scratching my head.
Well, I remember you looked at me with utter shock. You looked at me like I was like, I said something absolutely like horrific. And because you were so shocked.
Okay, but you hadn't, I knew you hadn't told anybody at the store. So that's where I was like, what?
And then that's what I was about to say. You were the first person I ever told.
Really?
Yeah, because there was such a safety in you because I saw myself in you. I saw this kind of like equal experience. And I thought, I can tell him, like, he's going to, number one, he's going to respect it. Number two, he's going to be curious. Number three, it's going to make us closer. I just knew it was going to be this like bridge. So I kind of dropped it. And I remember I was on call with my shift. I was never able to take an actual break. And I think someone needed me and ran out. But but then you came up and you're just like, I need more information.
That sounds like me, yeah.
And then that really became our friendship.
And yeah.
I want to stop indulging in my early love stories with you because people are listening for another purpose.
I will say one other thing, and I think this leads into our discussion, but I remember talking to you after I asked for more information, and one of the things we connected on was both of us had to learn all of these positions to stand in order to take eyes away from our chests, right?
Yes,
so you and I were talking about, oh, did you stand like this? I learned this one. Did you do the sort of pull the shirt out while you were working? And that, the fact that you knew how painful binding was too. And I think that really, it was so nice to have a connection like that where somebody understood. And again, this was 2012. We didn't have...
No, there was nothing. This was not cool. It was not in. It wasn't okay. It was like you told people in the little underground circuit who also got it. You didn't go beyond that.
You had to feel people out.
You had to feel people out.
I remember talking to you and I was like, tell me everything about top surgery. Mm-hmm. What did you do with the binders? And you were joking, but you said I burned them all.
I was partially joking. Well, you know, this is what makes the human experience so rich and my human experience so unique is because I was born so in the middle that I have experiences that no man has. I've experiences that no woman has. The closest people I have found that understand my experience are trans people, specifically trans masculine and intersex people. Those two people, we have similar childhoods, similar surgical experiences, similar adult experiences. So many things line up when it comes to our relationship with our bodies. And I think why I wanted to have you on this show, more than anyone I could think of, is because you have such a grounded, humble, light, compassionate way that you have navigated your transition and your experience. And I think it's something that I want to document. Thanks. So people listening have a model. Because like we talk often in the mainstream conversation, things are just so naturally divisive. So the moment something gets political, there's no conversation, there's just debate. So we are like, we're not inviting that. We're just letting that, we're letting them do their thing. And we're talking about our experiences that people can just kind of feel in and see if it sheds light on their questions or their concerns.
Yeah, I do think that's important because, like you said, it can just become such a debate and so aggressive, and it's nice to speak about it from more of a personal experience and just discussing what we've gone through. And again, I do want to point out that you are right that when you're growing up, now I can't relate to being intersex, but I can relate to the straddling the fence type of situation.
That's right.
And I think it's really important to discuss that. I think it's something a lot of people try to sort of push down. Like, I cannot, how do I put this? I cannot change that my childhood, my adolescence was female. I don't like to think about that, but it did shape me. And so I can't really say 100% that I have the same experience as other men. I don't. And in your case, you're talking about pretty much the same thing as somebody who is intersex, right?
It's true. And I think what interests me about that is, and you know, everything has spectrums, right? So in the spectrum of intersex, I don't have ambiguous genitalia. You know, mine's purely hormonal, my hips and my breasts and my brain in many ways, right? I mean, 12 years of estrogen dominance does something to your chemistry and your cells. So I had that experience, like you're saying, where it becomes like a gorgeous medicine for me. Like when I met you and when I was starting to feel into other people who were trans and people that were intersex, I was kind of finding these people in the woodwork, coming out of the woodwork. What really blew my mind was I saw it as a spiritual event. Like, to me, it wasn't political. It wasn't about identity even. It wasn't about medical. I understood the medicine of medical, you know, to let yourself be congruent with your spirit physically. Right. But to me, it was like so spiritual and otherworldly that in one lifetime, you can experience these 2, 3, 5, 6, whatever you want to call it, different genders, different expressions, different bodies. And it kind of proves the for me, it proves the, there's a word that's trying to come to me. It proves the existence of I'm consciousness, I'm not my body.
Yeah.
So how does that for you? Like, I'm curious.
It's actually really interesting that you brought that up because I haven't thought about it in a long time. But I was many parts before I was able to physically transition. So because I started socially transitioning when my dog sees something outside and I know this is going to be terrible. So my finger's on the mute button.
That's okay.
I started socially transitioning in 2010. And I
tell people what socially transitioning means, they understand.
Okay, so socially transitioning is I knew something was up and I started dressing male, and the few people I was able to come out to, they actually started calling me Kalen, which was always my preferred name. But in 2010, there wasn't a lot of recognition about it. So I had to feel people out and really hope that there wasn't going to be any kind of backlash. And there were so many different facets of Kalen, if that makes sense, because I did have to navigate different situations. So there was Kalen with friends, and then there was Gus at work, who was different from Kalen with friends. And then there was me at home at my parents, where I had to figure out how to switch out of a binder really quickly. And then there was another sort of sub-identity that I had at school in Utica. And managing all of those things is something that a lot of people don't get to do. Mm. And as frustrating as it was at the time, you do recognize it had a certain effect on you. And it really is, you know, when you try not to be angry at it, when you try not to be frustrated with the fact that you had to go through it, there really is something fascinating about it, where you yes. go, oh, this is something that I felt inside to the point where I had to make other identities to be comfortable. And that's really, as annoying as that can be, that's a really unique experience that I don't think a lot of people get to have.
Does Let's pause sort there. Of, that's so yeah. gorgeous. No, it's so gorgeous. It's exactly... It's exactly how I experienced it, because I wasn't even thinking about all the managing of my parts. I've forgotten about that because it's been so long since I've had to do that. But I remember distinctly, because especially, and this is something, again, trans and intersex people usually experience, when you have an ambiguous gender expression or an ambiguous body, mm-hmm. other people experiment their sexuality with you because they feel safer, because some of them don't see you as a human. Like, there's lots of different reasons. Many different. But I mean, I had a good 10 or 12 straight guys while I was growing up that I was like their muse sexually.
Yeah.
Right. But it was so dissociated. We weren't like in a relationship. It was you'd pretend to be sleeping, or you wouldn't be talking while doing it. You wouldn't speak about it the next day. Sometimes it was straight up assault. Like, there's so many different levels. But there was that part that I was managing. And then there was like, okay, the Luis at school that no one knows has breasts I'm managing.
Right.
And then there's Luis by himself in front of the mirror. What do I do with that? Like, there were so many pieces.
That one. That was an important one.
The mirror?
Yeah, I'm just going to adjust my camera really quickly. I have a broken chair and it just...
No problem.
Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't even think about the in the mirror, Luis, or the in the mirror challenge.
All these identities that we had to be really on top of to not let our secret out, essentially, yeah. right? And when the secret is your body... It's really big, because it's difficult when the secret is your sexuality. It's difficult when the secret is your religion, when the secret is I'm in love with this person. That's, I don't want to like play the game of mine's harder than yours. For me, my body, right. like when you're talking about positions,
yeah.
the amount of gestures and the four layers of clothing I would have to wear in the summertime, and all the asthma attacks I would have to face yeah. so I didn't have to go swimming in gym class. Like, all the, I constantly had to think one step ahead. Is this going to expose that I have breasts? And if the answer is yes, I had to do everything in my power to avoid that.
I think it's important to mention for people who haven't had this experience, when we talk about positioning yourself. So I had to bind, and I had to triple bind because I had a very large chest. Just as full disclosure, I had a double D size chest. I was very large, and I am 5'1". And so it was very hard to cover that up. When you're binding, you know something's there. It's sort of like a comb over. That's how I like to explain
it. Say it again.
It's like a comb over. Am I inaccurate?
It's so good. It's so good.
When you're binding, when you have a chest that you worry people can see, you learn how to stand
in a
way. So if you hunch your shoulders forward, it brings your shirt forward. So people might not see your chest as much. And
You learn about light, how light falls on the front of your chest. Everything you can imagine you learn about.
I saw a picture of myself before I got top surgery, and I am hunched. But it was such a natural position for me at that point.
You
talk about four layers of clothing. In the summer, I would wear gigantic hoodies. Large hoodies that were way too big for me. And people are like, aren't you hot? No, not at all. I'm great.
Well, it's as you're saying this, it just reminds me, you know, what was so strange for me. My dysphoria is different from your dysphoria. Same like felt sense, same way of life, all those things. Mine was like, I'm so male presenting, you know, especially when testosterone finally kicked in. It was like, you look at me, that's a young man, that's a teenage boy. You would never think there were breasts there. So like the shock, it wasn't this thing where I could kind of pass with my breasts. It was like, I'm not supposed to have breasts. And the few people that saw I had them brutally, you know, took advantage of me emotionally and physically.
Yeah.
So there was this immediate overcoupling of, if someone sees that I have breasts, I'm in trouble.
And also at the time, so again, we have the internet, we're in the age of the internet. People who are in our age range, though I'm 32, we sort of went between analog and digital, right? So the term intersex was at the time, and correct me if I'm wrong, it was only people who had ambiguous genitalia, and it was hermaphroditism.
That's right.
And now we recognize intersex as a whole bunch of different things, including hormonal intersex. That's finally gaining traction.
That's right. I just want to say, just for people that wonder, there's three classifications, right? There's chromosomal, which means you can completely express as male or female. You can look like the binary, you can have children, everything. Your chromosomes are intersex. Then there's, like you just said, ambiguous genitalia. And then there's the hormonal. So there's these three expressions that are classified as intersex. But yes, at the time, it was down to the genitalia, and it's all that mattered.
Right. And it was, you had to be careful. So I remember when I was seven, I told everybody, I am a boy. And, you know, my parents didn't care. They were like, oh, last week he thought he was a buffalo. Right.
He's using his imagination.
I got all my cousin's old clothing. I wore boots. And then when I was 10, I was told I couldn't be because I was missing a penis. And that just sort of, my mind just sort of exploded, for lack of a better phrase, because I thought that it would happen. I thought when I hit 13 or 12, I would get that. And having to hide that from people, suddenly I couldn't say anything about it. Suddenly I had to go to like the junior section of the female part of the department store. And it was so hard to hide that mentally. But you're talking about physically hiding it. And that is a different experience that we had, because in childhood, it was only mental and emotional for me. And for you, you had to physically hide something.
Yeah. And also to empathize with you, as you started, I always call puberty the initial transition. You know, we go from these kind of like asexual kids, kind of inherently fluid as children without all the roles put upon us. And then when the hormones come in, that's like our first transition into a sexual body. And so when that when nature's transition took over and you started growing different body parts, you know, and your body started changing certain ways and puberty came in, then it did become physical for you. Because even though you could pass to society, to you, it wasn't passing. To you, it was incongruent.
Correct. And I went through puberty very young. I was 10 years old. And I remember crying when I found out, you know, again, in my 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old brain, I was like, oh, I just wait, and one day I'll have a deep voice, and one day I'll have the right genitals. And I just remember crying because that all became a lie, essentially. Yeah. Everything I hoped for was just gone. And I remember having, when my chest started developing, and again, I was very large at a very young age. And I remember thinking, well, now how am I going to do this, this, and this? Because I would, you know, I would take my shirt off when I was a kid because, oh, I look just like the boys, right? And again, when you're kids, everybody looks the same, and then suddenly I can't do that? Why? Suddenly I'm not allowed to wrestle with my friends? Why?
I want to say I connect to this experience of the puberty shock, because what doctors had told my parents was when he hits puberty, his testosterone is going to come in and he's going to lose all his fat. And they would refer to my breasts as fat. So same thing happened. It's like I'm 12, 13, testosterone's finally kicking in. I'm starting to grow hair. I'm starting to hit puberty. All these things are happening. And my breasts are the exact same. They got a little bigger even. My hips started getting wider. I got stretch marks on them because they grew so fast. And I'm like, what's going on? And so there was a shutdown that happened where I didn't want anyone to know that these breasts didn't go away. Because now it meant they were breasts. It wasn't fat anymore. I had that as like an alibi in my mind.
Official.
Yeah, it was official. These are boobs. They're not going anywhere. Right. And so I thought, I've had so much shame, so much self-disgust, so much fear and panic, that at that point I made the decision, I will never take my shirt off again. Mm-hmm. And I didn't. Even when I was alone, I couldn't risk it even to myself. And so I lived a good decade in hiding, where no one ever was with me naked. No one knew what I was hiding under there.
I want to ask, in your case, was it was breast tissue, right? It wasn't actually fat, it was breast tissue.
So when I finally got top surgery at 23, the surgeon said, this is 99% breast tissue.
Right, because gynecomastia, which is, for those who don't know, the condition where men might have mammary glands that overproduce, that's usually fat. It's not breast tissue. And I remember, this is what I remember. I come from a long line of very curvy women. And I remember my mom taking me aside and saying, hey, people are going to catcall you. People are going to do X, Y, Z. It's because you have an hourglass shape. It's because you have a large chest. And one, my autism was just like, what do you mean? And two, I remember thinking, well, why would people do that? That doesn't make any sense. But also, how could my body do this to me? How could I go from just being able to like myself and, you know, have this hope that everything's going to turn out well, and now suddenly I have to watch how I dress? And, you know, my mom's from the South Bronx, so she was not, people are going to catcall you, you just have to accept it. She was like, this is what you do. But it was still Like, I'm getting a huge chest. Now suddenly my hips are big. Now I need to worry about it because people are going to... People weren't raised correctly and weren't taught. It was during the boys will be boys thing, right?
Totally.
And just, I'm not going to go into it right now, but just that from transition where I suddenly gain this male privilege. It's, I don't know how to explain it, but I wouldn't take off my shirt. I didn't start being physical with people until after I was 18. Even then, it was sort of like a this stays, like shirt stays on. And the issue I had was it was sort of, quote unquote, the only thing I had going for me. That is what people saw. They saw my chest and they saw it was big, and that is what they wanted.
I want to pause there because a common question for parents, for skeptics, people with dysphoria themselves, is what's the difference between I don't like what I'm dealing with in society with a female figure and I'm a trans man? What's the difference?
That is a really common question. And
in your experience, I should say, what was the difference? How did you navigate knowing I'm a man, I need to transition, versus I don't like what comes with being in a female body?
Honestly, I know this sounds really weird, but I had an experience when I was 15 or 16, and I saw a woman who looked exactly like me. I'd never seen that. She looked exactly like me. And she was maybe in her 30s. I was 15 or 16. And I remember thinking, I cannot be that. So the difference...
What did that mean to you? What was that?
If I grow up... Because I was 15, so growing up, looking like her, having these hips, having this chest, having that voice, I don't know what... I cannot let myself do that. And that is the best way I can explain it. I knew it wasn't, oh, I just don't want people to look at me. Because if you don't, then you can dress down, right? You can wear a shirt you got at the thrift store. That, and I did that. And it still wasn't enough.
Not enough for you.
Not enough for me. Yeah. And that's when I started recognizing, oh, it's my voice. I don't like talking to people because it gives me away. It's my hair. Not a fan of being bald, by the way, but much happier.
It's very natural on you. So you've given me permission to be devil's advocate in this, you know, because first of all, we're very close. You know, I love you. And the whole point of this is to bring out not controversy, but confusion, to bring some clarity. Right. So go ahead.
I do want to mention, I just thought of this, and it was such a part of my life that I don't even think of it as a thing. I tried to be that person who just wasn't comfortable. I tried. And it was a balance, right? So a lot of people might go, if I just do this, maybe I'll get used to it. Or if I just do, maybe if I don't wear shirts that are pink, or maybe if I wear, in my case, a sports bra and things aren't as obvious, maybe I can be that person. And I went from knowing I couldn't be to accepting that I couldn't be. Does that sort of answer your question?
Of course. I mean, when I hear that, I hear this, it goes from a thought into a felt sense. It becomes an experience where you feel in your bones,
right,
this isn't congruent with who I am.
Right. I don't like to be that person. I just knew, and I did experiment.
I'm going to pause here. This is what interests me. So this, I'm going to highlight the word experiment. So what I'm wondering, as I don't know. Are you considered a trans elder yet?
I'm considered an old trans person. Yeah.
Okay. So my old trans person friend, what I'm really curious. So there's, gosh, this goes so deep for me, this part, just because of my experience too. You and I, we grew up before medical transitioning was available for minors, right?
Yes.
We're just on the cusp of this being available, by the way. It's not like, I don't think it's widely in certain states, right?
No.
And so it's certain places, certain families, but it's something that is a big discussion. And I've had clients, I've had people come to me this last 2 years, especially saying, you know, my 10-year-old is telling me that he's actually a girl. Like, what do I do? And a lot of people, I should say a lot of people, I don't know how many people will listen to this with that experience, but I know a lot of therapists listen to this. And a lot of therapists, as well as these parents of these children who are questioning their gender and confused, some like, I know, like you're telling me.
Yeah.
They don't know what to do because their intuition wants them to be curious as parents.
Yeah.
Yet their politics is telling them they're being abusive as parents if they're curious. And so
now
is what I'm talking about. Yeah. So you and I had the experience, which now I look at as a privilege. At the time, I was like, get me the fuck out of here. But I'm actually looking back, I'm like, okay, I learned a lot about myself, where we were forced to be uncomfortable in our bodies. There was no way out. There was no, besides suicide, which I contemplated a lot, and I'm sure you did.
I did too. And a lot of people, that's a trigger word for a lot of people, because I think it's being tossed around now as, oh, if I don't know what to do, will my child commit suicide?
That's the urgency behind it. And I'm just going to say that I understand the fear, and I understand the people with dysphoria who would want to and have committed, because it's something I thought about every single day.
Every day.
Because you can say to yourself, okay, I hate the family I'm in. When I'm 18, I'm out of here. You can say to yourself, I don't like the state I'm in. When I'm 18, I'm moving to another state. When you have a body that just doesn't feel right to you and there's no way to escape it, that's where the mind goes.
Yeah.
And why I'm bringing that up is because you and I found a way to be with the discomfort. For you, long enough till you could transition. For me, long enough till I get top surgery. And before we go any further beyond our personal transitionings of our bodies, what was it like for you looking back that you can give us for wisdom and advice? How do we create capacity to be in the body that isn't ours while we're still developing? While we're still developing our brains, our bones, our nervous systems, all these things that we may not want to stunt with a puberty blocker. We might want to transition when we're done, you know, developing. But how do we hold that? It's so nuanced.
It's hard because you and I did grow up in a time where it wasn't even a question.
Not even an option, right?
Right. And we had to. So even when I was looking at transitioning, there were so many hoops I had to jump through. And one of them was, hey, you're going to have to be uncomfortable for a year.
What does that mean?
Identifying as male, but not being allowed to transition, not being allowed hormones.
So this is what we call the social transition.
Right, the social transition.
You can dress, you can say your name is this, my pronouns are this, but there's no medical transition.
No medical transition. And it's hard. I had to become used to what I'm dealing with, and I had to accept it because I did not have options.
What does accepting it mean to you when you look back at that?
This is going to sound very dark, but it means hoping something will be better one day and not killing myself that day.
That's important for people to hear. Let's just pause and feel that.
Yeah.
It's really important because that's the place we find ourselves in when we're dysphoric, right? It's like, I can kill myself and get out of this body, or one day it will be bad. That was my entire childhood.
Yeah.
And now some of the kids, their childhood is, I can kill myself or I can medically transition.
Right.
And I just wonder, if that was our experience, what would we have lost? What would we have gained? Like, what would that have been like for us?
That's a really good question. I've thought about that myself too, because if I had been given the option of puberty blockers, let's say, I wouldn't have had to have top surgery.
Exactly.
Right. But I would have also been jumping into something sort of blind, for lack of a better phrase, because it was so unknown for us. We had time to think about it. I didn't even know it was possible, because all you heard about was, and this is also going to sound terrible, but this was the case at the time, you've heard of transsexuals who were women who were either prostitutes or in adult films, or really gross, I can't believe Simon did that, and now Simon's Sasha. What am I supposed to tell my kids? That is all you heard.
I'm seeing Buck Angel in my mind right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was actually a situation I went through in high school, where a principal of another school transitioned and everyone was up in arms. I can't call her Gianna. I need to call her this.
I remember at the mall in my little Pennsylvania town, at the Aunt Annie's, the Auntie Anne's or whatever it's called, I called Aunt Annie. I was a pretzel, or I eat so many of those pretzels every day. But then, there was a transgender woman that worked there. And at the time, it was a transsexual.
Right.
And I remember just in my mind, they were my hero, because I just thought, oh, someone that probably knows how it feels. You know, that's just what I kept thinking. But they were an entire laughingstock of the town. Yeah. I mean, but her courage to like walk through the mall in her high heels. Again, this is before medical transitioning was even accessible financially. So she was socially transitioned. She was wearing like girl jeans, and she had her nails done and had like her hair all long and pretty, but everything else was masculine. And she had to find a way to build that capacity that I'm just going to be me. I don't care who's laughing. My life's at stake. But for her to not do that also meant her life was at stake. She was feeling incongruent.
Yeah.
So when you say we had all this time, that's, I really want to stay with that for a minute, because I am not for or against medical transitioning of any age. I believe the parents actually should decide. That's how I feel. I don't think anyone should decide but the parents. I'm thinking for myself, right? I'm thinking, what would that have been like for me? If a doctor told me, or my school or anybody said to me, you know what, you can actually get those breasts removed, I'd be like, sign me up now, like pronto.
Yeah.
No questions.
That's the other thing I wonder. Would I have been more proud if there was more acknowledgement? Would I have been, you know, just okay? Like you said, sign me up. I want testosterone. I want my breasts removed. I want all this stuff. Let's go. But it's hard to, you know, when I socially transitioned, I was so secretive about it. Nobody could know. I had to suck it up and just, okay, these people know me as female. These people know me as male. These people know me as, hey, he's just kind of a weird person. but had I been given that option, what would that look like now? Would I be like a proud trans person with my trans flag around my neck?
Yeah. Well, that's what really interests me, because for me, there's some, when I talk about like it was hell and now I see it as a privilege, which to some people sounds crazy, not to you, obviously. It's like I think of, you know, like when monks have to go through so many rites of passage.
Yes.
To me, having to live in a body that I hated and was ashamed of and got me hurt and made fun of and isolated and all these things, to live in that body for so many years, I think probably it was 12 years total.
Yeah.
I mean, it was 3 years, you know, to when it's top surgery, but like the real dysphoria only set in for me around puberty.
Right.
to live in that for those 11, 12 years, that gave me so much compassion for so many people.
Yes. And I think one of the things I want to write that down so I don't lose my train of thought, compassion. Yeah. I think one of the things I tell people, because when you get so depressed, when you get so upset that your thought is, you know what? If I commit suicide, this could all be over. This, I won't need this body anymore. I can go on to be whatever. Now I look back at that. I still have dysphoria. I want to mention that. It's still a part of my life, but it's lessened dramatically.
Well, we're going to go there in a minute. I'm ready.
But when I look at that, I go, hey, I battled my brain every single day. I battled those nagging thoughts. I battled everything and I won. And I think that's really important to consider, is I had to go through it. I don't like that I had to, but it did give me the ability to take on other things and to actually think of them from a different perspective too.
Hey, my friends, my next virtual somatic drop-in will be this Tuesday at 4 p.m. Eastern. These virtual somatic drop-ins are entirely pay what you wish. You can pay nothing, you can pay $20,000. I strongly encourage the latter. These are spaces for us to come into and learn somatic processes together, somatic techniques together, somatic language around trauma, so we can hold space for ourselves and others in a much more effective and kind and safe way. For more information on how to join this, just go to my website, holisticlifenavigation.com, click on events, and you'll see virtual somatic drop-ins listed there. You can register for free, and then during the actual event, we'll put out a link for donation if you choose to do so. Again, this Tuesday, 4 p.m. Eastern, we'll see you there. I mean, this is where I call, you know, like one thing I wrote down is invoking the middle person.
That's right? A really good way of saying that.
Yeah, and like the bridge person, all these different ways we can talk about it. Like our friend London would call it the two-spirit. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like how the for me to have to live in a body that was ambiguous and not have it changed for me early on meant I actually had to build capacity to be in both worlds. Yeah. Which, like I said, like you said, utter hell at the time. And this is what's interesting to me. I did not magically heal when I got top surgery. Like, I thought I was going to get top surgery and the rest of my life is going to be a breeze. I was going to love myself. Everything was going to be easy. I never had to tell anybody my past because I was still very closeted. I was not public about being intersex or having breasts or any of those things. And then when I got top surgery, a new problem occurred. I have hips because anyone that is born female or has a feminine body and gets top surgery knows that your hips are largely out of proportion now because your breasts actually balance them out. And you didn't realize that until you lost your breasts. Yeah. I'm assuming you had that experience too.
You still
know, you know what I'm saying? You look in the mirror, you're like, there's those hips.
It doesn't poke at me. I sort of describe different levels of dysphoria as, have you ever worn a pair of shoes that don't really fit, but you can get by?
Yeah.
So when you start in the morning, you're like, oh, I can get by, this is fine. But at the end of the day, they hurt so badly and it's all you can think of. That's sort of dysphoria for me, or the milder kind after I've got my chest. And that was the biggest thing for me, was my chest.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But when that was gone, I'll notice my hips more.
That's right. My hips don't lie.
I notice my lower half more than I ever did before. Mm-hmm. And those are things you can't change, your bone structure, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's something you have to learn to accept.
So pause there, because the pause right there, I want to go into that. Because one thing that I've learned from being dysphoric is it becomes a practice. And what I mean by that is it becomes a practice in one, for me, it's a two-part practice. So I'm curious what it's like for you. First part of practice is to look for the problem with my body, because I just got so used to hating it. Mm-hmm. And the second part of the practice is how to make it look the way I want it to. So do you have the same experience there?
Yes. I have found, people laugh at me about this, but I have found pants that slim down my hips. Mm-hmm. And those are the pants I buy. If they stop being made, I don't know what I'll do. So whenever I need pants, I get like 6 pairs.
Yeah, totally. Totally. But I'm saying that because when it's a practice for so long, like when we're talking like decades of the practice of using a hypervigilance to see what's wrong with your body, and then an equal hypervigilance to shift the way it looks, to look a different way in public, that doesn't go away when your body changes medically.
And something to add to that, I don't know if this happens to you or had happened to you. Every so often, I realize other people don't have to do this. Other people don't need to go to the store and go, okay, hope they still have those pants, and grab 6 of them.
Yeah, yeah.
And when that hits me, that's when dysphoria gets bad again. So I remember right before I got top surgery, I was getting ready for work. And again, I had a triple bind. Mm-hmm. And it just washed over me. No one else has to do this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, no matter what you need to do, again, he said it becomes such autopilot.
But that's what's so important to me, because, and I really am being careful, I don't like to make general statements. Like when I said dysphoria doesn't go away because you transition, who knows? Maybe for some people it does.
I apologize for that as well.
Well, I don't think you said it, I did. But I don't like sweeping statements of any kind. Mm-hmm. Like when I promote my course and I do the work that I do in the world, I never say like in 6 weeks, you're going to heal your trauma. Like I just don't believe in selling that to people. Yes. So I'm always like a little like leery when any group of people are saying this is going to fix you. And I really bought that, you know, like my surgeon was like, hey, you're going to be a whole new man. You're going to look great on the beach. Everyone, you're going to feel so good about yourself. And, you know, I'm not even going to blame him, because it was like me attaching to it. It was, it was a two-part, you know, bi-directional relationship. Yeah. But when it still, it took me, it only really 2 or 3 years ago started to lift. We're talking almost 10 years, no, more than 12 years after top surgery. It took to finally actually say, those are the hips you got, baby.
Yeah.
Let's play with them. this is the chest you have. It gets puffy sometimes when you have too much sugar around the moon. Like things change. I don't know any other man that goes, those are the hips you have, baby. Your nipples get puffy still sometimes. Yeah. And like you can't feel them sometimes because they were cut off during surgery. You know, like these are just rare experiences. So I'm like, can I love this part instead of the dysphoria continuing to say, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong?
I know I've said this like 58 times already, but it's really difficult because I spent so much time hating everything.
Yes.
And this is what I have. And you have to learn self-compassion.
Hmm.
That's the best way I can put it. I was lucky enough to have a gender therapist who was also trans. And he did explain to me, hey, you can have your chest removed, but it's not going to fix everything. And still to this day, because I was so large, I have what are called dog ears. So again, like I'm smiling about it because that's what it is. You know, I can't do anything about it. But basically I was so large that the side of what I guess what would be considered side boob. Mine still exists. It's just scar tissue, but it flops over like a floppy-eared dog. That's why they're called that.
Go ahead. No, please continue.
I've had to accept that. I don't want to, but I have to have compassion for myself. You mentioned the woman when you ate pretzels all the time who was brave enough to do that. And I need to remind myself, you were, I don't like the term brave, but you were able to put yourself through all of this.
That's right.
So that you could be as comfortable as possible. And you just need to accept some things. You know, this is who you are. And I did not experience sexual assault. I'd like to mention that. But I did experience a lot of folks who went, oh, this body's interesting. Maybe this and this. I need to remind myself that there are people who will not care, or there are people who will love that I'm shaped like a pear.
That's right.
And I've had to, when I get upset about it, I've had to remind myself, like, you've done this very scary thing. You're doing so much better. And you know what? That's just how it is. And I can either accept that or I can be really upset about it.
I mean, I think that's what I love, you know, when we're talking about our childhoods, because it was so different. Like, you know, we were really the unspoken ones then. So there wasn't anywhere to go for support. There wasn't anything on the television. There was no, I mean, the only thing on the television was mocking us, but there was
you
nothing.
Were always, sorry. It was
no,
always
go for it.
Butt of the joke, or let's show how amazing this straight man is for accepting this man who became a woman. Look at this straight, white, cisgender man and how good he is. Did you notice that?
Yeah, well, and that's what I mean. It was so, when you're watching these things and you have these kind of bodies or these kind of expressions, you're like, ooh, I'm not going to come out. I'm not going to talk about this to anybody. I'm not going to put myself up for this. And I think, again, what I'm saying about the gift of it, the gift of our generation and not having space, or I should say the experience of not having space for it, for me turned out to be a gift because of two things. I had to develop what you said, a sense of compassion. Even though when I was suicidal, when I completely went numb, just never felt my chest again for 12 years, you know, wore clothing, never took anything off, layers, never took anything off. There was still, I had to find these things about myself and about life I enjoy. That's what kept me here. Uh-huh. If I was just thinking about my chest, there's no way I could have survived. You know, I would have definitely been like one of those people who ended their lives because it would have been too much to bear. But it was like a practice of learning, how do I attune to the things that do work, to the things right. I do like, right? And I'm saying that because I find it so important. And I can say this just as my private practice when I've worked with people who are trans. Also, I've worked with people who have detransitioned. Mm-hmm. And I've worked with people that want to get top surgery and realize they're not trans. They just don't like the connotations socially that come with breasts. Like, I've worked with all of them. And so what I've learned from them all is, regardless of what they do or don't do, they have to practice self-love. The surgery is not self-love. The surgery is like, I'm getting myself congruent to how I feel, but that doesn't equal self-love right away, right?
Right. It takes, first off, I want to mention that all of the types of people you just mentioned, trans, people who detransition, everyone is valid.
Everyone's valid.
So I just want to mention that.
And everyone deserves to fuck up. Yes. Like, if you are trying to talk someone out of doing something because you don't believe them, let them have their experience.
Right.
Right. You can transition and realize, nope, actually I'm not. And detransition and feel more like yourself. You can transition like you did and realize, yes, like I'm getting closer to how I felt my whole life.
Yeah. I think I tried my best to recognize that the world has more beautiful things to offer as well. I can focus on my hips and how much I hate them. Or I can make fun of it. You know, I do. I collect things with people who know if I'm in a restaurant, I'm not getting black tables. That's just how it is.
Oh. Totally.
I know. And yeah. I'll say something like, excuse my childbearing hips, because I can either laugh about it or I can dwell on it so much. And I spend so much time after puberty dwelling on it and dwelling on it. And the world has so much more to offer that can take your mind away from those things.
Well, as you say that, I hear, and we are so much more than our genders or our bodies. Like, that's one little piece of this physical experience on this planet and spiritual experience. But we're so much more. Like, your amazing saxophone playing has nothing to do with your gender expression. Your incredible ASL skills, the way you hold space for people, your social work. There's so many things you do in the world that... Yes, the lens that you see the world through and the way you show up to people, I think, is so profound because of your experiences of suffering and getting through that suffering. And they're not married to your gender expression.
That's really important to bring up, too. And by the way, I see those same things in you because I think it really is a unique experience and something that I've come to really cherish, for lack of a better phrase, because it does give you this ability to see things from so many more different angles. And I wanted for such a long time to forget that I was born and raised female. I wanted to so badly, but it has also given me this incredible insight into the world working. And it has, as much as I dislike this, people will always say, oh, you're such a sensitive man. Well, I also experience something most men don't experience. And that is not to say cisgender men cannot be sensitive, but there are things that I have the privilege of having known. And I have to remind myself of that. When I look back and I go, that was terrible, I can also look back and say, oh, but I learned this and I know how to deal with medical professionals who don't think women know what they're talking about. I know how to navigate certain systems and certain conversations now and how to communicate with all different types of people with all different expressions because of that experience. Do you find?
Yeah, see, well, you're expressing to me the early training we went through to become middle people, you know, and really bridge people. My friend Marguerite calls it being a bridge. Now she's like multi-ethnic and speaks two different languages. And one side of her family is from Puerto Rico. I think the other side was Irish. Okay. And so she has this bridge experience, which is like, I can relate to so many different people because of this ambiguity I have ethnically. And that's how I feel. I feel like that ethnically as well, but I especially feel like that through gender and sex and biology, because there aren't many men that can say, I've experienced misogyny, you know, like being hated because of a female characteristic. It's rare. And it doesn't mean, I do not like to perpetuate the idea that like, cis men are these horrible people and they never deal with pain and they're the problem. I don't believe that at all, actually. I believe everyone has their own experience. It's going to be their own pain and suffering. I don't like to compare. I don't like to say mine's better or worse. All I'm saying is mine is unique in the same way yours is and a lot of people in our experience, because what they see is not what's actually underneath and what's not our history. Right. And there's a secret a sneakiness to that. It's like a trickery, you know?
I don't know if I told you this story, and I'm going to try to not swear or anything.
Oh, you're allowed to swear.
Okay. When I moved to Brooklyn to finish school, I was paired up with this man named Anthony. He was from Long Island. And he was just, think of an Anthony from Long Island. I hate to be that person who's stereotypical.
I see him right now.
Is legitimately the person I was working with. And we were working on a project together and we were walking to school. And he said, "Hey, Kalen, are you an ass or tits man?" And I said, I believe women are more than that, man. I will not forget this. He said, "Yo, are you gay?"
I've been there, like, "Oh yeah, I'm gay because I respect women." That means I'm gay, right?
That, or, and when I told him, you know, I didn't come out to him as trans, because that response alone.
You didn't, you said?
I didn't.
Got it.
Because that response alone was enough to tell me, no, don't do that. But when I said, you know, "Oh, I'm bisexual," he was just sort of like,
And can I catch that?
It's going to jump out at you. But it's my experience from before of being seen as tits or ass. It gave me this ability to really look at that and go, I didn't know people spoke like that. And maybe he's not feeling it himself. Maybe that's society telling him, "Hey, this is what you're supposed to talk like."
Well, and that's really how I see it. And what's so beautiful about being like that bridge person that we've experienced.
Great way to say that.
Yeah, because we got to be on both sides in these really unusual ways. So it's almost like being a spy. You know, you get this like straight up front row experience of the human experience. And you get kind of like, not both sides fully, but both sides in such a spectrum, in such a way, yes. Right? Of really under, because you don't know the full side of what it's like to be an adult woman loving being a woman.
Right.
You just know what it's like for your body to have been female at birth and developed. And then the shift happened, you know, when the developing started, then you went into transitioning.
That's a really good point too, because I remember trying so hard to say, okay, what would a woman say in this situation?
Right.
So yeah, I do have an experience from socially being seen as a woman, but you bring up a very good point that mentally I was not. But also, similarly here, I get to see what it's like to be male, looking like I do, but I can't help but be reminded that some of my parts just don't match when I'm talking to someone who's cisgender. Do you ever feel that way?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because mine's more subtle in comparison to yours, right? But absolutely, I mean, the moment I'm at the beach, the moment I'm at a creek side, if I would go to a men's circle and like we take off our shirts for whatever reason, there's this immediacy of like, oh, this is... It even, because I know where my body comes from, I know this isn't even my natural body. So right. When I'm there and I appear to have this, what we think like a normal male chest should look like, I know this isn't actually how I was born. Like, I know this.
Yes.
I can't pretend otherwise. It just doesn't work. I've tried. And the trying to me was, and this is part of the controversy that you and I share. Mm-hmm. Is that we still honor our biology. Whether we identify with it or not is one thing, but we honor it. Like, there it is. You know, it's like, I was even told afterwards, if I ate foods that were estrogenic, that when Eamon got pregnant, I could grow breasts again, that they could come back. Like, there's a chance, very low chance, but the doctor said there's a rare chance these could come back under the right circumstances. Mm-hmm. And so to pretend that I'm just a regular guy because I got my breasts removed, that's a lie. I'm allowed to not tell people if it doesn't feel safe. I'm not saying that. But for my own relationship to myself, I've learned to love, okay, I have an intersex biology and I resonate more looking like a man. That just resonates more for me.
Yes, that's...
Where does it go for you? Because transgender is very different than what I'm saying, I think.
It is and it isn't, because again, I accept the fact that I will never biologically be male. And some people, how do I put this? I know I'm always going to be in between. What hormones have done to my body is so helpful, but I'm never going to be, for example, this just happened recently. I was hiking and I had to pee so bad. I had to pee so bad. Yeah. And I was with a cisgender man who did not know I was trans, and he said, well, just go. And I was like, oh, and I had to come up with some excuse. And I was like, you go ahead. I'm really pee shy.
but, you know, I actually am pee shy, so that would have been true for me.
No, that worked for me, but it was...
But that's that moment. See, this is, okay, this lights me up, because these are the moments of humility. Mm-hmm. Like, these are the moments that humble us into this, again, middle person experience. And why I love you, why we connect so well in this, again, I think it's very generational, and it's also just also how we are, because not everyone from our generation agrees with us. We do not speak for people who are intersex or queer or trans. We speak for us, right?
For us, yeah. Our experiences.
Yeah, for our experience. But there's a humility to this daily reminder that I am doing my best to express myself physically that feels congruent with my spirit.
Right.
And there's this thing that will always tell me, and that's not your nature, physically speaking, not spiritually, physically speaking.
That's such a good way to put that, because there is always this little, like, poke.
There's always a little poke. It's like, and, don't get too comfy in your ego. I'm going to remind you that you're not like other men. And some people, the controversy around that is it's been used against trans people to say, like, you're not man enough, right, or you're not real, or you're not valid because of that biology. Whereas I see that as like a PowerPoint. I'm like, that's amazing that my biology is in between. Like, that's to me, that's brilliant. It's nothing to be ashamed of. Easier said than done. But I'm curious for you, it's like, you seem like you're past the shame. Like, you and I laugh about these things. Like, yeah. What? I mean, are you bypassing, or are you really okay with it?
Am I bypassing shame?
Be like spiritually bypassing by just laughing it off? Or do you really feel okay with the humility of, yo, right, there's that lower half? Like, I'm curious.
I would say it teeters.
Mm.
I'm sort of like a seesaw.
What does the seesaw depend on? Like, what allows you to have the humility of it? And what allows you on some days to feel really overwhelmed and ashamed?
Again, this sounds weird. So I'm in Vermont, and Vermont is known as a pretty liberal place. But the further north you go, so the Northeast Kingdom is one of the hardest places for me to be okay with it. Because there's a lot of... Again, I don't want to do a sweeping motion, but what I've come across is a lot of more discomfort with the possibility of me being this way. So, again, this is odd, but when I go into hardware stores, that's when I become so much more aware of it. When I'm talking to, you know, out here, it's all granite. When I'm talking to men who have been working in the granite shed since 1974, that's when it becomes the most shameful to me. But, and this is something I don't know if we've touched on before, that it's not willful ignorance all the time. There are some cisgender people who do want to know, and they do want to understand. And so when I'm around people like that, where I can tell they have no ill intent or no malicious intent, that's where I go, oh yeah, I have this experience, I have these parts, and even though I'm not comfortable with them all the time, it does give me something that I can share for people who don't know about, as you would say, butch people, who don't know about people who have multiple sides. So I would say, depending on the person I'm interacting with, if I'm at home, and this is bizarre, I don't think about it. I don't go, oh, my hips, oh, my lower half.
Not bizarre to me at all.
Did I make dinner?
I love that. See, now that lights me up too, because it points to when we're in our place of safety, you're just with your nature. You're just with what's natural to you. Like, this is your body. This is where you are in life. It's when that body is being confronted with something externally where there could be danger. I'm sure that's the dysphoria heightens.
It heightens. I do. At home, it does pop up sometimes. There's no getting around that for me. But it becomes worse when I am around tradesmen. And, you know, there are... I went into a consignment shop once and I had this huge bruise on my arm because I was working on a truck. And there was a gay man there. The consignment shop was run by two gay men. And so there were a lot of gay men who would go in, and they were old queers, as you would put it.
And, me personally.
And I went in and he goes, "Ooh, girl, you look butch." And I was like, I was like, no. And this was after I had transitioned. It's one of those things you hear, like, older gay men saying to each other.
Oh, that was how I talked to all my queer friends growing up. We were like, girl, bitch, you know, that's just how we talk to each other.
But I had this huge bruise and he said, "Don't you look butch?" And I just thought, I just don't have enough money to get a mechanic. Like, so that is sort of like a, oh, look at me. I'm so comfortable with this. But then, you know, I had two landlords. They could not know. They couldn't know. And that is my dog.
Okay. I have a question because we have to wrap this up soon. I mean, there's so much. We could literally talk about this for hours. There's so much I haven't even begun exploring.
I'm sure there will be a part two.
There will have to be a part two. But I'm curious, how would you feel? I have two things. How would you feel if I asked you a couple questions that were just kind of like speed round, where you just say for you what you do, things that people might find controversial, things that people might really want to know, things that trans people or people who are questioning or dysphoric are like, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Would you be open to that?
Yeah, just don't go too fast because sometimes... my ears don't hear as fast as you speak.
I'll speak slowly. Okay, so what is your personal choice around telling potential lovers that you're trans?
Oh, my personal choice?
Yeah, like how do you navigate that?
I don't.
You don't navigate it?
I don't. I do not date people. I don't look for people. It's so hard to figure out when or how to tell somebody.
So the fear of telling them freezes you from pursuing.
Yeah, that's where the black and white thinking comes in. And also, you know, I do have autism and people think I don't because I speak well. But when you go up to somebody and you say, "Hey, first thing, I'm sure you've realized I'm autistic. Second thing, also maybe don't have the stuff you think I do." It's so hard to navigate.
Has your experience been doing it? Like, where have you experienced it being accepted or not?
A lot of it was before I transitioned, where it was, for lack of a better phrase, a lot of repressed straight men who knew before and we're just looking for an in-between way. Am I gay? Am I straight?
Yeah.
A lot of it was more friends that I had who I trusted, who knew already. I've rarely had to say, "Oh, hey, I'm trans." I currently have a friend right now who has no idea. I have no intentions of being in a relationship with him, but I still don't know when to tell him. Or do I tell him?
Right.
It's so hard to navigate.
So now on that question, again, personal choice, mm-hmm. not for anybody else. Do you believe that if a gay cis man is turned on by you and then finds out you're trans and he's no longer attracted to you because of your lower half, do you believe he's transphobic?
No. People have secondary sex characteristics, right? And I find there are some people who are really attracted to genitals. That's their thing. That's, you know, I'm a gay man. I love male genitalia. That's my thing. And there are other people who go, okay, well, let me think about this. You present male, you act male. Maybe that's okay for me. Maybe I will see what's going on and see, hey, is this something I can like? But I don't consider it transphobic. Because let's be honest, it's the kind of shocking thing. It is. Now it's much more acknowledged, but it is a shocking thing. And I've had people say, you know, I like you, but this isn't something I can do. And I understand that. Did that answer your question?
Absolutely, absolutely. What would you say to someone who wants to transition to cure their dysphoria?
Speak to older trans folk and intersex folk who we have information from a different time period, from doing lots of research. And again, pre-internet, this is how you learned things, right? So you found Ray, the 50-year-old gay man, when you were 14, and Ray told you all the stuff that nobody would tell you at school, that sex ed didn't tell you. And we actually are a wealth of information. And the internet is filled with so much contradictory information. Dysphoria, for me, never went away. But there's so much more to that conversation than what it did for me or what's happening now. It's good to ask people who have experience that you can speak with one-on-one.
I love that. You know, I'll say that you were a big, you know, as much as you're my friend, you were also my mentor in ways you might not understand. For being a man, because I was so turned off by masculinity because of the pain and trauma that I had experienced with other boys growing up, and my own ambiguous body. I didn't really understand it. I never identified as male until I started hitting puberty. So to me, it was strange to be masculine. It wasn't a good thing for the longest time. But you represented and represent such a beautifully balanced expression of, to me, the kind of man I want to be and like to be, which is this open, welcoming fluidity of masculine and feminine energies. You know, you're not a caricature of men. You're not this, you know, you're not a drag king. You know, like you're not trying right. to assert your maleness.
No.
You're just so naturally you. You know, you're sitting there in one breath fixing my car, and in the next breath, you're knitting me an octopus.
Yeah.
It's like, true stories, by the way, everybody.
Yeah.
So it's like, you have such a beautiful, like, as a bridge person, all of your parts, they come in so beautifully. And you don't repress one or the other in the name of being male. So I would ask you, based on my own experience with this, do you experience masculine, feminine, as separate from male or female?
I'm thinking about how you phrase this, separate from male, female.
I can phrase it another way.
Yes,
would, do you see masculine and feminine as energies that can move and shift, or do you see them tied to being male or female?
No, they can definitely move and shift. I think you're a really good example of that too. And I didn't realize that you felt that way about me, but I used you a lot as well. one of the things I like to say is that you and I are gender role fluid. So I remember a time when I told my parents I was transitioning, and my dad said, "But you run like a girl." And I was like, "I've run like someone who is not athletic at all." And I am very secure in the fact that I am male, but I am also accepting of the fact that I crocheted you an octopus and then also changed a light bulb in your car. I need to accept those things. Again, it's one of those things where I grew up with, you know, even though I didn't feel female, a very gender role, like, this is what you do. So, of course, I weave in between everything, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. That's all for now.
Yeah. That was a lot. I
think that's enough for you and for everyone listening. And I'm going to actually play Bridget's song, you know, at the end of this.
Yeah.
Because could we take a couple minutes to talk about that? Are you open to that?
Yeah, that's okay.
But so I wrote this song, which, I mean, what is the term for this? I know people call this their dead name. They're like, what's your...
I always refer to it as my birth name because I'm an old trans person.
I prefer that better, actually. Because it's I don't think we're killing these parts. I think we're transforming them, right?
Yeah. I have to recognize what was before. And I would say it's my birth name. I don't like saying it or hearing it, but in this context, I was so honored that you wrote this. It was so kind, and especially because it was before I even transitioned, and you wrote this song probably before, I mean, you knew automatically, but I think before I talk about wanting testosterone, you just did it, and that it was such a beautiful thing, and I just want you to know that.
Well, I thank you. I mean, music has always been super magical to me because it's how I process things, how I feel things, but it always moves through me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was so touched by you as a person when I met you. I feel so close to you. It just flowed right on in. And it's a really fun, catchy song that everyone loved when we would perform it. It was like, yeah. Everyone, if I was ever going to be famous, it would have been with that song. And I think the most fun part about the song for me was to highlight the spirituality of transitioning. And, you know, I did it with a bit of a almost satirical reference of you transitioning into a stag eventually, which is your actual true spirit, but male was the closest you can get on this planet.
Right? Yeah. Well, did you say that because I would feed the deer all the time?
I say that because you are a deer.
That's
when we are like walking down the street and there's like a buck and it just stares at us, I'm like, there's Kaylin. You know, it's like you're just an Amen 100% agrees. You just are a deer. And yes, you were the only one that they walk up to and eat out of your hand. So there's obviously a connection there. But I just always loved, you know, when I would think of the transgender experience and when I still think of it, again, to me, especially before it got really political, it's so spiritual to me and it's so magical and it's so art. It's like an art form to me. And so when I wrote the song, I was really musing of this idea of like, well, you really could be a stag in spirit, and you're not going to transition to a stag, but a guy is close enough in this lifetime. And it's my way of kind of like tipping the hat to the magic of these transitions.
Well, that's also what's so nice. It was so kind too, because it wasn't, yes, I transitioned to male, but when you transition, there's a lot more to it than just transitioning to, you know, a body I feel more comfortable with. There are so many types of transitions that go with that transition. And to see it put in those terms, it was just magical is the best way to put it. It was just so sweet because it wasn't definite, right? It was accepting of every transition I could go through. It was talking about, oh, he could do this and this and this, and it's ever changing, so to speak. And that was just really, it wasn't something I had thought about before, and it brought to light that there's much more than just this blanket transition and so much information that I have and so much experience that I have that is valuable.
Well, it was a pleasure that it came through me, and I can't wait to share it with everyone listening. Before we close and I share it, are you open to people emailing you? How can they reach out to you? Like, tell me anything here they should know.
Let me think here. I'm horrendous at answering email.
Yes, you are.
I'm so bad. But
they don't have to. You don't have to contact you either. You can be this mystery man.
That's the other thing, though. I think education is really important. And I think having people to speak to is really important. So let me think here. I'm going to say the best email address to reach me at is gusmanning195@gmail.com.
So it's cool.
Yeah.
So we'll put his email in the show notes.
Cool and, guy, 463 at AOL.
Yeah. Weird one, 69 at AOL.com. Yes, we are. So you can go into the show notes and get his email. And Kaylin and I were kind of just like casually dreaming up the idea of hosting some kind of circle, some kind of Zoom space that could be a somatic support group where we can talk about dysphoria and learn how to build capacity for it while we're questioning, while we're still developing, while we're transitioning, whatever it is we're going through. And that's something we might do. So you have his email, you can reach out to him. Thank you for being here with us, my friend. I wanted to introduce the song properly before I play it for you. This song is called Bridget's Song. It was released on my first studio album in 2016, titled Wholesome. You can find it on any music platform out there. And Bridget's Song is a song about Kaylin, a song about transformation, and a song about the magic of witnessing your body as something else. And Kaylin is a brilliant saxophone player, and he toured with me for years, and we played as a duo where we would, I would beatbox into a loop pedal and play the piano and sing, and he would back me up with saxophone, and it was really, really fun and beautiful while it lasted. And so you can hear him playing saxophone on the song, and his saxophone part really beautifully symbolizes the celebratory nature of his transformation that he would make. So this is Bridget's Song.
You never looked good as a bride. You never looked good as a bride. You never looked good as a bride. You crossed on to the other side.
You never looked good as a bride.
You crossed on to the other side.
You never looked good as a bride.
You crossed on to the other side.
You never looked good as a bride.
You crossed on to the other side.
You never looked good as a bride.
You ditched your wedding dress, then you carved off your chest. You crossed on to the other side. crown. Never had a doubt. All he knew that you were the answer to you. You crossed on to the other side. 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 You are a choir boy enthroned. The moon shape shifts your woman bones. And what would make society scorn you more than for you, to transition into animal form and grow horns, and grow horns, and grow horns.
So that's the end of today's episode. Notice where you feel the episode inside of your body. Those sensations, those expressions, that's how your body speaks to you. Sit with it, be with it, and let whatever wants to come up, come up. Because all the wisdom you're looking for is right there in those sensations. If you want to go deeper into these practices or find more information about my work, please visit holisticlifenavigation.com. I'll see you next time. Hey everybody, it is time. It is time to hop on a plane, a train, a boat, a goat, a bike, a car, and find your way upstate New York to a little town outside of Phoenicia. I don't know what the town's called, actually. But the place that we're going to be in is called Menla. And it is a gorgeous, epic retreat center in the middle of the forest in the Catskill Mountains with a spa and organic vegetarian food with lots of beans and yoga in the morning and a swimming pool and a swimming hole and trails. And yes, it is an HLN retreat. It is a 5-day retreat from Wednesday, June 12th to Sunday, June 16th. It is the biggest retreat we've ever put on, and the entire team is going to be there. They are all flying from different corners of the country to come together to hold you in the healing magic that is somatics. We will be teaching you how to belong without having to fit in, how to find safety inside of yourself and share that with others, how to receive witnessing, how to feel for your boundaries instead of fawning. We are going to cover so much, and you're going to be doing it in the most ideal setting of being fed, of being loved, of resting, of enjoying the forest and nature, and being with us and 60 other bodies. So please go to the website, holisticlifenavigation.com, and click on events, and you'll find it there. Wednesday, June 12th to Sunday, June 16th. All the info as well can be found directly through the link in this episode details. I am just so thrilled for this, and I can't wait to see some of you in person.